Good evening, everyone. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Christopher Dumbleton, and I am sitting in tonight for Norman, who is currently in Mexico at Mardahari at the Rohatsu retreat. Hopefully he's experiencing warmer weather, but I'm not sure. At any rate, I'm going to be talking tonight on the, I was speaking tonight on chapter 5 in the Dhammapada called The Fool. But before we start my talk, I'd like us to revisit the homework that Norman gave us at the end of the last Dharma seminar. It came from verse 50 in the last chapter titled Flowers, and it goes like this. Focus not on the rudeness of others, not on what they've done or left undone, but on what you have and haven't done yourself. Well, from that, Norman extended a practice from the sixth Buddhist ancestor, Wei Nung, who said, I see and I don't see. And when asked what he meant by that, he said, I see my own faults, but I do not see the faults of others. Also, I want to bring to mind the sixth grave precepts, not to speak of others' errors or faults. Well, I believe Norman's discussion prompt for small groups and then our homework following the Dharma seminar was to see how we related to not focusing on the faults of others in our daily experiences and as a practice. So before I open this up to comments, I just want to bring forward two lines of another verse from chapter 18 in Gill's translation, verse 252. It's easy to see the faults of others, but hard to see one's own. So I'm going to open the floor and let Shafi call on people if they have comments or questions.
Meg.
I really struggled with this and continue to, because I was raised in a home where focusing on my own faults was the drive, and where fault finding, blaming, really, in many ways, and well, I shouldn't say in many ways, it was a an abusive practice of really pointing the finger at us, blaming us for all kinds of things that we may or may not have had anything to do with. But so I found last week's session to be really troublesome for me. The part that was helpful is to not look at the faults of others. The part that I struggled with was being asked to look at that level at my own, which I'm really, really, really good at. So...
you've probably had a lot of practice at that.
Tons.
Yeah.
Lots. So it was just my reaction to those readings and to the last session.
Thanks for the comment, Meg.
Marianne.
You're muted, Marion.
I was really surprised to find out how much I blamed other people. I didn't really know I was doing that or finding fault with other people. It was very disturbing and very enlightening. It was a wonderful practice. And something that I'm now working on.
Thank you, Marianne. That's great. Yeah, as it says, it's easy to see the faults of others, but hard to see our own sometimes. Yeah.
Well, I'm good at that too.
Yeah. Okay.
Betty. One thing I found, I teach a lot of people, and that I find what Meg was saying to be very true is it's, very, very common and easy for people to, it seems, to just feel they're at fault, that there's a lot wrong with them, and that they're very, it's very easy for them to think, have a lot of shame about themselves. But I think thinking of that word fault, that could be a fault. The fault might be that one thinks, has such a lowly opinion of oneself, and that one doesn't really take care of oneself in a way to be kind and to really see one's strengths. So I kind of just turned that around to think of one's fault might be that one sees. Not doesn't see the good in oneself and have a loving attitude toward one's life and takes good care of oneself in that way. So,
Yeah, well, I
thank
agree
you.
with that, Betty. That's wonderful.
Jean.
Well, I've been practicing with it this week, of seeing, trying to see no difference in myself and between myself and others. So seeing but not seeing, seeing another person but also realizing, someone was telling me a story the other day about, an elderly aunt, and how that aunt had been very critical of her for many years. And she said, I realized that she was just scared. And then she said, and I realized I was just scared. And it was such a touching moment. I thought, well, yes, every time I feel a judgment, if I turn it around, it's usually. I at least share it, if not, I'm even better at it.
When you say turn it around, do you mean focus it on yourself
Well,
or?
yes, when I think, when I think if somebody is annoying me, and I'm having a judgment about it, it's actually very true that I can be annoying and. And that whether I am in that moment or not, but it's a way of kind of maybe equivocating or having equanimity, I guess, practicing equanimity.
You know, I find that I practice with my judgments in the same way most of the time. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you.
John.
Yes. Hi, Christopher.
John.
This one speaks to me more of humility. It's, and I think humility is very much an important part of our practice. And it's so easy to point to others or to make judgments and to forget, well, wait a second, what about yourself? What are you doing? What are you feeling? And especially in this political climate, it's very, very easy. But I also think women are much better at this than men are, in general. Just in general, I think that men often project, and it's important for us to really internalize and to take responsibility for our own actions and to see ourselves. So that's how this speaks to me. And I think it's very, very, very much a part of our practice to be humble and to own ourselves, and to not judge others so much. Right. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Sue.
Well, just a quick comment, thinking of what John was saying, that I've heard it often said that the very things that we are most annoyed by in other people are, we're annoyed by them because we recognize them. They're something that we do, and we're annoyed. We're not really admitting it, we're projecting, but we're annoyed by the things in somebody else that we do ourselves, and we notice those things more than we notice things that we're not doing. So it's useful to turn it around, as John said, in another way, maybe, and think, oh, am I annoyed with that because I do that? So it's a good question to keep in mind.
Yeah, it's a good practice. Yeah.
China.
Thank you so much. Thank you for Christopher for taking up the mantle tonight. And thank you everyone for your meditation and consideration. This is the perfect message for me tonight. As you know, I live with some of you know, I live with nine other people in an unintentional community. And it's been very, I've been trying to introduce this notion because there's complaints about this or that, people complaining about other people. So it's just this rich field for me because then I want to tell them to stop. And I have to keep turning it back on myself and just remember to put out what it is I would like, which is finding something positive and being grateful for the gift we have, even with our unintentional community. I mean, it's just a rich field. And boy, a hall of mirrors. And that's what I have to keep remembering. And just because I've had a little exposure to the Dharma, I am not inoculated or free at all from constantly judging and having opinions. And there's an older person here who was about to get evicted, and I got, I did have to say something because it seemed as though it was over nothing. It was over getting old. And anyway, I think at least she's been given a reprieve. So I'm glad I said something, but we don't have a clear process. So it's 10 people sort of floundering, and I'm asking again for a house meeting where we can have what's called, I guess, nonviolent communication or safe conversations. So it's a gift to keep being reminded. And thank you so much for your reflections, each and every one of you.
Sounds like practice. You have a very rich work environment in terms of your Dharma, in terms
Yes.
of your practice. Let's maybe one more comment from Michael, and then we can move on.
Thank you. Thanks, Christopher. I just went for a walk before turning to our seminar tonight, and I ran into my next door neighbor who's been a little unfriendly to us. He's been there for a while, and I've been habitually annoyed and you are often annoyed in encountering him, as I was tonight. And as I went on my walk and, sort of churning this annoyance. I remember Norman talking about the yogic nature of this practice of kind of turning away from the annoyance, and you know, there's this energy that I don't know if I am kind of drawn to the energy of annoyance in some way, maybe, or but turning away from it, it opens up other, it opens the energy to other subjects, you know, other subject matter in my life, other ways of being that it's just interesting to notice. And you know, liberating in some way, although it's there's difficulty there that's interesting also, I think. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks for bringing that up, Michael. It reminded me of a story. I don't know if I've told it or not here, but a while ago, I had a neighbor who I would, hear yelling at his kids, and I'd see him driving his big truck with his red MAGA hat on, and I think, oh. And then recently, a big windstorm blew down this fence between our properties. And so we ended up collaborating on rebuilding this fence. And I learned all these amazing things about this person who was really a kind soul and really very helpful to me and to Ginny. And it was like that, even though we were rebuilding a fence, we built a connection. So that was really wonderful. Great opportunity. Anyway, I'm going to start. On my talk. This is on chapter 5 of the Dharmapada, called The Fool. So when I think of the fool, what comes to mind is the iconic fool, the medieval court jester, the one who is ridiculed at first, but then evolves into a speaker of the truth, able to deliver criticisms indirectly. Mostly, they are exempt from punishment, though some went too far and were beheaded, literally. But such the fool was free to speak and could become a moral compass, as in Shakespeare's King Lear. The fool became the sage. However, in the context of the Dhammapada, Gill, in his notes on the chapter, defines the fool or bala as a young child, childish, and finally as a foolish ascetic. Now, I found this focus on asceticism interesting. As we learn from the life of Buddha, in Thich Nhat Hanh's Old Path, White Clouds, Siddhartha's spiritual journey led him many years after he had left home and perfected his meditation practice to engage as the monk Gautama in a practice of being an ascetic, not bathing or cutting his hair and eating very little. Ultimately, several other monks joined him in this ascetic practice in order to find mastery over their physical desires. Well, one day, after 6 years as an ascetic, the Buddha woke to realize the middle way, that he didn't require him to deprive his body and practices of extreme mortification in order to achieve enlightenment. So, to the dismay of his ascetic community, he bathed and drank milk and ate food to nourish his frail body, and realized that nurturing body and mind was essential to full awareness. This understanding of the middle way led to the embodiment of the Eightfold Path. So, as I enter the chapter 5 verses of the Dhammapada, I will be switching between Gil Fronsdal's and Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translations, though I found them for the most part consistent with each other, At times, I prefer the wording of one over the other. So getting back to the chapter at hand of the Dharmapada, the fool, which appears to be a dichotomy with the following chapter, the sage. So, verse 60 in Tanisaro's translation. Long for the wakeful is the night. Long and weary, a league. For fools unaware of true Dharma, samsara is long. So have you ever, like me, woken up at 1 or 2 in the middle of the night and found it nearly impossible to get back to sleep? Well, my mind was swirling and prevaricating, unable to settle, seeking answers and solutions to an endless list of seemingly unsolvable problems. If I were to look deeply, I might experience the feeling of endlessly wandering in this mundane Saha world, a cycle of birth and rebirth to which life in this material world is bound, rudderless. In my waking life, without awareness of the truth of the way things are, I'm stuck in limbo. So I, along with you all, study myself and the Dharma. Verse 61, Dhanasaro. If in your course you don't meet your equal or better, then continue your course firmly alone. There is no fellowship with fools. I found the teachers who, or teachings which we encounter on our spiritual path, and I encounter on mine, that encourage and support us as we grow are very important to recognize and to listen to. Now and then in our spiritual journey, we may encounter someone who shouts that they know the truth. Just follow me and everything will be okay. But hopefully sooner than later, we realize that they just want followers. Followers who will glorify and emulate them. And we must find a way to abandon them, for that is not a community of our equals and betters. Verse 62 from Gill's translation. A fool suffers, thinking, I have children, I have wealth. Oneself is not even one's own. How then are children? How then is wealth? In a couple of days, I will travel north with my partner to visit our daughter and her family, including my grandchildren. I look forward to being with them, particularly my grandchildren, and watching them as they grow, knowing that someday we will part. As we hear in the Five Remembrances, all that is dear to me will change, and I will be separated from it. My actions are my only true belongings. A while ago, actually years ago, I was walking in the country with a friend. Knowing that he was nearing the end of his life, he stopped, and gazing at the surrounding trees, grasses, sky, and valley, he said, I'm going to miss this. Well, when I die, I know I will miss all those who are dear to me and all that which is dear to me, wishing I didn't have to suffer those losses. However, I also know the truth of impermanence, and that my suffering is born of my attachment to those people and things. And yet, this seems to segue into verse 63 from Gill. Fools, conscious of their foolishness, are to that extent wise. But fools who consider themselves wise are the ones to be called fools. These wise fools are those who, for the most part, are self-aware, not centered or caught up in their own foolishness, believing it to be truth. I think the fool does not act foolish on purpose, unless he or she is trying to entertain or perhaps make a satirical comment disguised as a joke. I related the following event in a recent talk I gave on the first pure precept, which I titled, First, Do No Harm. In the majority of my working life, I worked in residential construction, building cabinets, remodeling, and ultimately building homes. In the stages of my career, I took on increasing responsibilities. At one point, early on in my career, I was a crew leader on a house building project, and in that capacity, led the team of several carpenters in an activity that went awry and resulted in one of the carpenters being hurt, not seriously, but causing him to miss some work. I had made a poor calculation. It was my fault that he was harmed. At the time, I believe I had more concern about being wrong than for the safety of the workers. This attitude involved an element of hubris. Overly self-confident, my foolish pride caused harm. Verses 64 and 65 from Gill. A fool associating with a sage, even for a lifetime, will no more perceive the Dharma than a spoon will perceive the taste of soup. A discerning person who associates with a sage, even if for a brief moment, will quickly perceive the Dharma as the tongue perceives the taste of soup. Well, just because you are in the presence of wisdom doesn't mean it will rub off on you. As much as I might have wished as a youngster, putting my homework under my pillow as I slept didn't help me much in the classroom. Until I allow my mind and heart to open to the Dharma's teaching, whether it be in words spoken or read, or actions perceived, I will not taste the truth. As we chanted earlier, an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Verse 66. Fools, this is Tanisaro, fools, their wisdom weak, are their own enemies as they go through life doing evil that bears bitter fruit. I retitled this Ignorance Harms. With little or no awareness of the Dharma or the effects of their actions or words, a fool is like a bull in a china shop, causing harm to others and themselves, and ultimately creating destructive waves and bad karma. Verse 67 and 68 from Gill. No deed is good that one regrets having done, that results in weeping and a tear-streaked face. A deed is good that one doesn't regret having done, that results in joy and delight. I found both of these verses seeming quite straightforward and clear. Bad deeds result in suffering for oneself and others, whereas good deeds bring happiness and contentment to all. When I've done something foolish and harmful, and am aware of the unskilled nature of what I've done or said, I feel a strong sense of unease and perhaps regret. I wish I hadn't done that, and hope my transgressions will be forgotten or forgiven. If it involves being disrespectful or hurtful to someone I care about deeply, it carries an additional burden. But when I've done or said something that brings joy or comfort, it evokes a warm feeling. I like that. Verse 69, Tanisaro. As long as evil has yet to ripen, the fool mistakes it for honey. But when that evil ripens, the fool falls into pain. It's like having a plan that seems good until it isn't, and then things fall apart, in this case, into a world of hurt. This verse seems to imply that fools, oblivious to the unskillful things they've done, believe that everything is just hunky-dory. But then the pain that that fool has visited on others does a U-turn and lands in his or her lap. Verse 70. Month after month, a fool might eat only a tip of grass measure of food, but he wouldn't be worth 1/16 of those who fathomed the Dharma. This refers to the story of the ascetic monk Jambuka, who practiced extreme forms of self-mortification and denial, which included eating very small portions of food which were picked up with the tip of a blade of grass. One of the shorter stories about Jambuka says that due to negative karma from past lives, he practiced this form of asceticism for 55 years until he met the Buddha. After hearing the Buddha's teachings on the middle way, he renounced his ascetic practices and became a disciple of the Buddha. His worth, through embracing and understanding the Dharma, increased exponentially. Verse 71, Gill. Like fresh milk, evil deeds do not immediately curdle. Rather, like fire covered with ash, they follow the fool, smoldering. This is a very vivid image of bad karma. Sometimes it seems it takes a while for the effects of bad karma to manifest, but suppressed, it can erupt unannounced. In our foolishness, we might assume that we have escaped the ravages of bad deeds and the requisite karma. I know I've done that. Thinking that I can hide behind my good deeds, I don't have to take responsibility for my screw-ups. And momentarily, I forget that the awareness of what I've done or said is securely parked in my gut and in my mind. No escape. Verse 72 from Gill. Reasoning is harmful to fools. It ruins their good fortune and splits open their heads. For the fool, ignorance is bliss. Truly understanding the Dharma would upset the fool's apple cart, making him or her aware that their good fortune comes at a cost. Worst thing ever for a fool. Not to humiliate the fool, but imagine how a deep understanding of impermanence and no self might blow their mind. Verses 73 and 74. Again, Gill. Fools will want unwarranted status. Fools will want unwarranted status. Deference from fellow monks, authority in the monasteries, and homage from good families. Let both householders and renunciants believe that I did this. Let them obey me in every task. Such are the thoughts of a fool who cultivates desire and pride. Not to name any specific political figure, but doesn't this sound familiar? So, why do fools want unwarranted status? Well, in order to get whatever they want and puff up their ego, having everyone bow down to them, overconfident and blind to the needs of others, the fool, in his arrogance, wants everyone to glorify them and their achievements. With unchecked authority in monasteries, or our communities, or our country, the fool expects everyone to fall in line behind their commands, cultivating their desire and pride. But as we know, pride goeth before a fall. Finally, verse 75. Dhanasaro. The path to material gain goes one way, the way to unbinding another. Realizing this, the monk, a disciple to the awakened one, should not relish offerings, should cultivate seclusion instead. This seems to me like a very calming verse, bringing me down to the truth. Though not a monastic community, as ordained priests and lay practitioners, this final verse of the chapter seems to sum up for us the themes, giving us clear instructions. we have a choice: material gain or liberation. Cling to the things this material world offers us and makes us feel better in the moment, or find happiness and love and connection in non-attachment, wisdom, and compassion. I know I choose the latter. Thank you for listening to me, and please forgive my mistakes and occasional foolishness. So it's time for us to go into small groups. And what I want to do is I want to go back to verse 62 from Gill's translation. A fool suffers thinking, I have children, I have wealth. One's self is not even one's own. How then are children? How then is wealth? So I want you to consider how attached you are to certain things, or especially people, a partner or a child. We tend to refer to those things as my car and my 401k and suffer when the car is damaged or the money invested is lost. More so the ones in our life who are dear to us, my wife or husband, or my daughter, or even myself. So consider that as you go into small groups, and Shufi will put you in groups of three, hopefully, with three and 3 minutes, and an additional three to wrap up. I'll see you when you come out. Thank you again.